This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Hello, you're listening to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Dashrin Johan. Our global political economy is going through some massive changes. Many experts have said that we could be witnessing the slow decline of the US and Western Empire right now. Are we moving towards a multipolar world from a unipolar world? What role will China play in all of this? And after more than 40 years of neoliberalism, why are we seeing a growing fascist or right-wing populist movements across the world? These are big questions. So to help me unpack everything on today's show, I will be in conversation with Professor Venkatesh Atria, economist and activist from Tamil Nadu, India. Prof. Venkatesh, welcome to the show. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Good to see you, Dashrin.
Before we talk about some of the big issues when it comes to global political economy, I want to get to know you. Tell me about yourself. Who is Prof. Venkatesh and the work that you do?
I grew up as the last child of a very large family of a school teacher in one of our villages. He passed away when I was hardly a year and a half old, so I don't know my old man. But my unlettered mother brought us up amazingly well. We didn't have landed property or anything, so we were lucky to get educated and survive. And this is partly due to our higher social standing. Even though we were poor, we had this access to education. I believe coming from an upper caste family and making it through poverty, I believe this is because of our advantages over a long period. So it's very important that we give that advantage to the oppressed of all sections. So anyway, to cut a long story short, I moved to Chennai from the village when I was about, my family moved, when I was about 8 years old, 9 years old. And then I went to IIT Madras to do a bachelor's in chemical engineering. Not that I really wanted to go to IIT. This is a done thing. So you, at 16, what do you know? So I get into it, and then I knew right away that this is not what I want to do with my life. I love chemical engineering. I took a degree in chemical engineering, but I basically had by that time become much more interested in the society as a whole and social issues. So I decided to do a PhD, although I had, you know, fellowships for MBA program and so on. I said, no, I want to do a PhD in economics with a naive notion that I would, that would enable me to understand poverty and how to deal with it, because I had no idea what economics was like.
Right.
I had no idea what mainstream economics was like. It's all about hiding the reality of poverty. But you know, I thought, okay, I'll learn economics. So I went to the US and had a fellowship, did academically very well, but that is not the important part of my US stay. The fact that completely apolitical person like me, when I left for the US, became much more political in the course of the anti-war movement in the US. I went there in 69.
Right.
And when I went there in 69, I was just a good boy, you know, boy who does well, gets high marks, obeys his parents, is, you know, completely uncritical and outcome, more or less, let's say. I mean, I began to have some stirrings. It was a basic humanism that was there in my head, but not a very worked out scientific understanding. I started moving left, then I had to understand these questions. Who is the US in Vietnam? What is it doing in China? Who is it all over the world? And so there was a very good group at Madison. We first cut our teeth in grassroots struggles, for example, against the companies going to South Africa to recruit, apartheid South Africa to recruit, or to the neighboring countries. And we formed a study group on campus, which worked through Das Kapital Volume 1. That's my education.
When did you go back to India?
You know, I was in the US till 75, from 69 onwards. I finished all my coursework very early, but I took a long time after that because I got into activism. Then the emergency was declared in India during Indira Gandhi's period.
Right.
It was a national emergency. Then I said, what am I doing here? You know, the emergency declared, then I'm making, sporting all these slogans. What the hell am I doing here? So I finished my thesis the next few weeks and submitted it and went back to India in 75 October. That's how my career in India began. After that, I've never been back to the US, by the way, last 40 odd years, not even once. So I got in the thick of the emergency regime. I worked under a pseudonym. I had a professional position in a big research institute, but I was known underground as by some another name. So I took some classes for activists and all. This is about 18 months of underground political life, fresh right. from the US. So it was all exciting. I'm not sure I understood all the implications, but anyway, I did instinctively. I was, and also more and more theoretically, I was part of the movement. And so I wrote a series of articles in that period from 1976 May to 1978 July in a very important scholarly journal called The Social Scientist, which comes out from India.
Right.
And this is a Marxian political economy, 13 papers written under the name A.V. Balu. Mm-hmm. They have been published since then in 2012, because I was not going to be only an academic. Although I got into an academic position in Tamil Nadu, which is where I speak the language. So there were, you know, suggestions that I should go and work in Delhi. But I thought that if I wanted to do mass work, I should be in a state where I speak the language. Of course, one could have, in principle, right. learned Hindi, but that would have taken some time. You're still not quite there. No? Linguistic nationalities are important in India. And I'm a Tamil national.
Right.
I'm an Indian citizen, but I'm a Tamil national. So, you know, this is a contradiction that, of course, you know, my rulers will probably call me anti-national for saying this, but there is this linguistic nationality, which is important, where you can talk to the people, right? So I started doing that kind of mass work, taking classes for employees of unions, for Kisan Sabha, with farmers union workers, agriculture workers union workers. This has been my career for about, from 1977, almost 50 years. I've been an activist on the left, while also doing scholarly work and writing and guiding dissertations and so on, all that.
What did, reading books like Das Kapital and, you know, being part of the anti-war movement, what did it teach you about, one, I guess, global politics, and number two, what did it make you reflect about Indian politics?
The mainstream economics that I was learning at Madison did not answer any of these questions. Why is the US in Vietnam? Why is it bombing Indochina? Why does it have troops in 100 countries? Why do European and Western countries behave the way they do? Why do they exploit the entire third world? What is the nature of the ruling classes in the third world? These kinds of questions the movement teaches you to ask, Marx teaches you to ask. So I would say that if I had to be grateful to particular forces, it would be one, the Vietnamese people, and the Indochina people for a heroic fight, the American student movement, which opposed the war, and then, of course, Marx intellectual. So intellectual influences on me at that time were primarily two important. One is Marx, but also Simone de Beauvoir, whose books, The Second Sex, I read in 70. So I come from a very patriarchal culture, where, you know, you're patriarchal without even being aware of it. You're unconsciously imbibe all patriarchal values. So in the beginning when I went to the US, these are the values I held subconsciously, not perhaps consciously. But reading Simone de Beauvoir opened up a whole new world. And I just became a kind of a passionate advocate of gender equality. This is the time of the Black Panthers movement.
Right.
Who were being cruelly attacked by the US government. And when I was there in Madison, Fred Hampton and Mark Clark were killed in Chicago. These were defining moments of a more radical consciousness. So I think both theory and practice are very important. I've never considered being a pure academic or being just a flag-waving activist who doesn't do theory. So I believe that I am privileged enough to have had education, so that must be made available to the people. What made this life possible is because I had a spouse who shared this ideology.
Right.
So her role is equally important in my being able to function as both a political activist. Her name is Chandra, and we met and married by choice, and which was quite an event in those days, some 50 years back.
Yeah.
But she was also in the same movement as I, and we worked together in the left movement. And she kept me on my toes, and kept me on the right side of gender justice. So, I think due credit will be given to her as well.
So, Prof, you look at global political economy every day, you monitor what's going on, not just in India, but across the world. What worries you the most today in 2024?
Well, first of all, the global capitalist system is a system that will inevitably provoke wars. Capitalism means war. Imperialism means war. So right now, we have two major wars going on in Palestine and you could hardly call Gaza a war. Gaza is genocide by Israel on the Palestinian people. But you have the Ukraine war, where the expansion of NATO has provoked Russia to react and carry out an attack on Ukraine, which I don't justify, but I can understand where it came from. This is one thing. So this means that as long as capitalism exists, and you look at the entire history of capitalism, it has never been without wars. Throughout this so-called peaceful period from 1945 to 91, before they broke up the USSR, even then there were wars. Well, you had Vietnam, you had the interventions in Iraq and other places, dismemberment of countries like Libya, which were like, and Sudan. I mean, you just name it. And all over the world, this has been a phenomenon. So war is an integral part of capitalism. Pursuit of profit by large private capital inevitably leads to wars. So that's one reason why one would be very keen to change the world. That's one reason. But apart from that, specifically, in the last 30, 40 years, following the collapse of the USSR and the rise of neoliberalism, there's been a sharp increase in inequality, both within nations and across nations. It's a scandal, first of all, that with the world as advanced as it is in science and technology, you're unable to feed the people. This is an absolute scandal. There's no rational explanation for it. The only culprit is basically the system, the social system in which you're operating, driven by profit, not by the need to meet basic human needs. So yeah, I mean, that's where my concern is that we now have also considerable evidence that if capitalism is left uncontrolled, that we're not able to overcome capitalism as an economic system, the world as we know may not exist either. Climate change is a crisis we are facing. You know, there are multiple crises today, food crisis, the climate crisis, and the basic crisis of war. It's clear that capitalism is the major reason for the destruction of the environment. So there's no getting away from it.
You mentioned something very poignant, which is how capitalism is war, or it perpetuates this endless cycle of wars. How would you respond to the argument that wars predate capitalism, and that some people might even say that, you know, it's human nature. If regardless of the economic model, people will go to war about religious issues, other identity issues, cultural issues. During the feudal time, there was also wars and conquerors and all of that.
No, I'm sure there were local conflicts over resources, especially in periods of scarcity in earlier times. But under capitalism, it is a very peculiar phenomenon of crisis caused not by scarcity, but by apparent overproduction, right? Hmm. It's endemic to capitalism as a system because it's driven by profit. So if demand is not there, if the production doesn't get demanded, we have a crisis. So the shops will be full of things, but you will be unemployed and not able to buy it. So there's something specific about capitalism. The reason why war is associated with capitalism is because capitalism, in its monopoly phase, it becomes completely war system when it's in the monopoly phase because the competition among big capitals. This is systemic. This is, capitalism driven by profit will constantly seek newer and newer pastures. It'll turn every human activity into a profit-generating activity. I mean, what has happened to the indigenous citizens of North America? Or, take your own country where you are, Malaysia. What was the situation under British rule?
On the show with me today is Professor Venkatesh Atria, economist and activist from India. We will continue our conversation after the break. Keep it here on Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Darshan Johan, and on the show with me today is Professor Venkatesh Atria, economist and activist. This conversation will also be available on podcast. You just have to look up Beyond the Ballot Box on the BFM app, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from. We would really, really appreciate it if you subscribe to us on Spotify and drop us a review. So, Prof, before the break, you mentioned that under capitalism, as time passes, it will turn every human activity into some form of commodity anchored in the profit motive. I'm reminded of something this philosopher from the US, Michael Sandel, he mentioned something where he said that over the past 40 years, we have gone from a market economy to a market society. What do you think of that?
Capital volume starts with the commodity. Everything gets commoditized under capitalism, right? Everything becomes a matter of exchange value, which is a phenomenal form of value. Value is the social labor embedded in a commodity. But he says that everything, and he says including love and justice, everything becomes a commodity for sale. To go back to that 1950, same time that the Soviets had this enormously impressive growth, the Western world went through the economic depression of the 1930s. Two wars, First World War, Second World War, so the 30-year crisis of capitalism. So at that point in time, a very different balance of class forces internationally had emerged. This is what led to many West European countries and UK adopting social welfare systems. There's no gift of the finance capitalists. They had a world to contend with, and if they didn't do something like that, the working class in Europe, which had taken part in the anti-war movement, which had also had a large left influence at that time, both communist parties and socialist parties, would have moved radically to the left. So to forestall that, the advanced country finance capitalists offered this social democratic compromise idea. That arrangement, whereby organized labor would be a partner in imperialism in the Western world for its survival, that collapsed immediately after the collapse of the USSR. All the privileges were being taken away one by one. Pension, this, that, everything was under attack. Today, the Western working class is much weaker compared to what it was like in the Soviet days. So one of the first impacts of neoliberalism, therefore, was on weakening the working class. There were three items of agenda which both Reagan in the US and Thatcher in the UK in the 1980s spearheaded. One was to weaken the socialist camp, because as long as the socialist camp existed, the working class in the advanced countries and the third world countries would both stand up to US and to imperialism to some extent. Second, you had to weaken the working class movement in the advanced countries, because they were providing the support for progressive thinking and so on. Third, you had to destroy the power that third world countries exercised using raw materials like oil, for example. So the event in 1973. You see, in 1974, the 37th General Assembly session of the UN, a resolution was passed calling for a new international economic order. It talked about reparations for colonialism. We cut 12 years later to 86 to the Uruguay round of negotiations in WTO, which led to the ultimate emergence of WTO from GATT. Seems dramatically different. The agenda was placed by the advanced countries. They said, we want to bring in services. We want to bring in agriculture, we want to bring in rules, trade-related disputes, intellectual property rights, the works. Whole agenda of development of the developing countries would now be essentially decided at forums like WTO, the World Bank, and the IMF. So this was the dramatic transformation that neoliberalism brought to the global political economy, first up. And this was preceded by those three objectives that I mentioned, that destroying, weakening socialism, weakening working class movements, and weakening the third world countries. This is basically the agenda there.
What about the 90s?
In the early 90s, we had three major developments to contend with. One was the collapse of the USSR and therefore the rise of a unipolar world under US hegemony. This is one thing very important. But the second thing was, with the ascendancy of the US as a unipolar, the head of a unipolar world dominated by capitalism, second thing was therefore the spread of neoliberal ideology and practice across the world. Right. So, large swing to the right in terms of political economy. The third was the rise of, range of proto-fascist, neo-fascist, fascist, right-wing also came along with the neoliberal economic ideology. So neoliberalism was not only an economic phenomenon, a very important political phenomenon. You see, this widely used concept of the fiscal deficit, used to bully developing countries and saying you must not have a fiscal deficit greater than something. What is this fiscal deficit? Very simply put for our audience, it is total expenditure by the government minus what are called non-debt receipts. Receipts are not debt. So you can have taxes, you can have surpluses of government-owned enterprises if they exist. You can have charges levied for services by government. All this legitimate income. And you can sell government assets and derive income. That's legitimate. Although remember, these are not government assets. They're people's assets, which the government they chooses to sell. But in any event, these were admissible. But borrowing was not admissible. So borrowing would not count legitimately as income. This is the crux of the fiscal deficit concept, as opposed to the earlier classical budget deficit concepts, which didn't mind borrowing because the borrowing was seen as necessary for growth and so on. And government was seen as an agency which had a role to play in growth. You had this, the phenomenon in the late 40s, early 50s of the state playing a key role in development, even in the advanced capitalist countries, excluding, of course, the US, but the US had also an important role. But developing countries at that time, it was a given that you would have the state to play a principal role as an agent of development. India, Malaysia, India, all these countries followed that. And now everywhere, neoliberalism has come. So, you know, in a sense, the weakening of the state has a different significance for the third world as opposed to the first world. Because for the third world, taken collectively, the state was an important instrument in fighting imperialism. Post-World War II, from roughly 1945 to 1973, until the first oil price rise and the recession of 74-75, until then, 30 years of growth of the global capitalist economy at an astonishing rate by capitalist record of about 5% per annum growth of GDP. This is astonishing because capitalism had never had an uninterrupted 30-year growth. It always had cycles, 5 years, 7 years, 10 years. So at the time of the end of World War II, the apprehension in the Western world was of stagnation. I said, what are we going to do? War is over, people are coming back. They won't find jobs, there won't be demand. And the Cold War, of course, came to the rescue. The most important consequence of 30 years of its growth was the accumulation of huge profits and surpluses in the hands of big global capital. And all this entered the international financial system. The second stream that came to provide governments the finance capital was actually the oil dollars, which are not invested in their people, but were also brought into the financial system, following the massive rise in the price of oil in the early 70s, again in 78. The third, most finally, that this was the time in the mid-70s, late 70s, when a large number of people who had entered the workforce in countries like the US and the Western world in the post-war recovery were about to retire. Around 1980 was really these three flows, that the surpluses of large global MNCs. All this was possible because of the sheer military power of the US. It's not just the dollar. The dollar is a piece of paper, but where does the dollar get strength from? It comes from the dominance of the US as a military power. No? Never forget the link between militarism and capitalism. Never forget it. So this mainstream that came from surpluses of MNCs, second that came from the oil revenues of the oil exporting countries and the, of course, global oil MNC, the third that came from the working people of the Western world. Now, in all of this, the complicity of third world country governments should not be missed.
How do you respond to those who say liberalism is freedom?
What has been called liberalization is a very nice word. You know, you want people to be liberal in this fascist culture. But what they have in mind is not liberal to you and me. They are talking about deregulation. So the correct word would be deregulation. Our great Dr. Ambedkar once said, somebody asked him, what do you think of liberalism? And Ambedkar correctly replied saying, you mean the right of a capitalist to throw out his worker, the right of a landlord to throw out his tenant? I'm not for that liberalism, is what Ambedkar said, just for the record. But deregulation is what they have in mind. What does that mean? It means that the big corporate entities should be absolutely free from any norms of social accountability. They're not answerable to the people, they're not answerable to the government, the parliament, nothing. See? So no regulation. No regulation of the, they don't say no regulation of labor. They want labor to be regulated thoroughly, controlled, working day extended. That's the flip side of it. But freedom for capital. Unlimited freedom for capital to perform free of all regulations and controls. This is the first component of neoliberalism, which is wrongly called liberalization, but this is actually deregulation. Second, privatization. Now, this is often narrowly understood only as the government disinvesting. turning over companies to the private sector. Well, that's important too. Second aspect of privatization is the abandonment by government of its historic responsibilities for healthcare, education, all the covenants you have in the UN. This is a paper, you know. So basically, governments all over the world in the neoliberal period have been abandoning all their commitments to health or education or other social welfare goals. These are all now driven by profitability considerations. So the second important point. The implication of this particular aspect of privatization is that healthcare, education, drinking water, roads, people's infrastructure, all these become inaccessible to ordinary people. See, what has saved the world from total chaos is the autonomous advance of science and technology, growth of productive forces. You know, today, even a worker has a cell phone, which is important for the person as an instrument to reach his or her employer. So this, the general rise in living standards across the globe on account of scientific advances, nothing to do with capitalism. Capitalism has actually held back the benefits of that advance from people in a very important, many important ways. So this is the second aspect of privatization. Both aspects of privatization have to be fought. Third aspect of neoliberalism, we talk about deregulation, we talk about privatization. Third is globalization, quote unquote. Okay, this is the most popular phrase. Now, there are two aspects. One is purely as an economic measure. I'm not talking about cultural globalization, right. I'm not talking about other forms of imperialism and racism and so on, but even as an economic measure, in economic dimension, there are two aspects. One is trade in goods and services. There's been complete liberalization of trade in goods and services. The other is the flow of capital as finance across country borders. They've been completely deregulated now. You know, despite the disastrous experience of the 1990s, Russia, Southeast Asian countries, one after the other, despite the 2008 crisis, we have now a regime where private, large private capital flows of finance held by a handful of speculating magnates is free to move across the world. This is the single most important agenda for neoliberalism. 1980, the single most important agenda was how do we ensure the free movement of capital as finance across countries. Even trade was secondary. Trade was there. When WTO pushed hard on trade, so they had markets to create and all that. But this third aspect of globalization, namely liberalization of trade in goods and services, plus the complete freedom of movement for capitalist finance across country borders. These are the three components of neoliberalism. In a country like India, for example, I've written about this extensively, I'll send you a link. What this has meant is that, you know, since capitalist free to move, and since you've liberalized imports and exports of goods and services, you run huge trade deficits. India's deficits on what economists call the merchandise trade deficit. That is deficit, meaning the difference in the value of exports of goods and the value of imports of goods, physical goods. This is huge for India. 30 years, every year we run a huge deficit. So how do you make it up? We get some net surplus in services. We have IT, IT-enabled services, we have English as a language here. The state has educated a lot of people, not the private sector, the state has educated a lot of people. It's a public sector service. This has enabled us to acquire foreign exchange from foreign exchange from the IT, IT-enabled services and tourism. So this fills a small part of the gap. Then one more component, which is labor, which has moved to the rest of the world and is sending home remittances. Ordinary working people, printers and carpenters and so on, nurses, women who send home the money. This has been an important source of foreign exchange. But despite that, despite these two items, net services, net forex because of services and forex coming in because of remittances, we still run a large balance of payment deficit in the current account. So what this means is that we are at the mercy of international finance capital. In order to, you know, meet our immediate need, we need foreign capital flowing in all the time, foreign exchange coming in all the time. So governments are basically held ransom to global speculative finance capital. This is the crux of neoliberalism. This is what dictates reduction of deficits. And moreover, it dictates reduction of deficits based on the premise that you should not try to reduce deficits through taxes, but you must reduce it only through expenditure reduction. Subsidize capital, eliminate working people's subsidies.
Today we have China on the rise. there's been a lot of talk about moving away from a US dominant unipolar world to a multipolar world. How are you analyzing this situation? What challenges and opportunities will it bring about?
You know, I think it's very premature. But fact is, in terms of sheer absolute size of its economy, China stands number one, more or less, and can confront the US like no other economy can. But what I visualize is that the US dominance will survive, not go away overnight. Okay, it's going to be there for a while. We have to live with that. We have to fight it. It must be undermined, but it cannot be undermined overnight. So even though the, okay, put it this way, from 1992, when Fukuyama said the history had ended, to the 2008 crisis, when global financial crisis became a global economic crisis, to 2024, we've seen 15, 16 years of very low growth across the entire Western world, and a rising problem of unemployment, both of which underlie the growing power of the right-wing neo-fascist forces in the Western world. You have seen a considerable weakening of the power of capitalism to influence politics in the Western world. I mean, the big capital still controls, calls the shots, and it continues to garner profits from all its activities across the world. But it is seriously threatened ideologically in its own territory by the rise of the new right. But, you know, if you look at phenomena, like, you talk about multipolarity, but you're talking about Finland and Sweden becoming members of NATO. What are we talking about? There's no unambiguous move towards multipolarity. And the US and European imperialist powers are determined to build a very strong military alliance. And they've strengthened it by incorporating historically neutral social democratic countries into it, which is a very alarming development for me.
It is.
On the other hand, Turkey has taken a somewhat different turn from the rest of the group. Now, look at Orban of Hungary. They're all tiny countries, comparatively speaking, but they made a big deal of it because the press is dominated by the West. We are much bigger countries than Muslims. Malaysia is a much bigger country than these tiny city-states. But nonetheless, you know, if you look at Poland or Hungary, you know, strengthening of right-wing tendencies in Europe. And look at the history. You know, you look at Italy, Spain, Portugal. These are all historically fascist countries. After all, Portugal and Spain were, you know, democratized only in mid-70s. So, you know, you have an environment for a right-wing dominant, US-dominated polity across the world. Move to multipolarity is not easy.
And we are seeing the same thing across the world right now, right? I mean, Modi is essentially an ethno-religious populist with fascist tendencies. We say, you know, we saw Bongbong Marcos get elected in the Philippines. Ethno-religious politics is more popular than ever in Malaysia.
When capitalism enters its in an ultra-monopoly phase, as it is doing currently, fascism is the appropriate, or fascism or fascist-like tendencies would be the appropriate political responses which are functional to the system, right?
Right.
So it is not as if the US ruling classes is fighting fascism. It's not. The strengthening of NATO and bringing it to the borders of the Russian state is no accident. The posting of China as the number one enemy is no accident. So, you know, the people who interpret the rise of the right wing in the Western world, independently of the ruling regimes there, are making a mistake. The right-wing regime, the trends are consistent with the underlying philosophy of the ruling regimes. In advanced countries, the rise of ultra-right political ideology is not essentially anti-capitalist. It's pro-capitalist.
Yeah.
They may use all sorts of words. They may even wear anti-capitalist costumes. But no, they're fundamentally strengthening the rule of monopoly capital across the world. They'll be as brutal and ruthless as anybody else. Now, interestingly, you know, we talk about Trump. What was the record of Hillary Clinton? As far as the third world is concerned, who does it matter if it's Hillary Clinton, Trump, or Biden? Biden has been the worst abettor of genocide for months on end now, absolutely without a qualm. So, you know, you have an extremely dangerous imperial power in the US, which remains strong, She's also accumulated more allies in this period and brought them closer. So, you know, before I talk about multipolarity and de-dollarization and so on, I'd be extremely cautious. Not that I don't recognize those trends, they also exist. But we live in a very complex world of contradictory developments. And so, you know, I want to just place that on record, that the rise of ultra, what they would like to call ultra-nationalist right-wing trends is not inconsistent with the class interests of the dominant classes in the US. Coming back to Modi, what Modi is pursuing is not ethno-religious movement. That's a wrong characterization. He's pursuing policies that we have described on the left as corporate Hindutva. Okay, essentially, its political economy is corporate. Its idiom is Hindutva.
Right.
Very interesting political tactics that they're following. They have been able to capitalize on the huge insecurities of Indian working people on account of neoliberal policies, which they are, in fact, if anything, the Modi regime has implemented ultra-neoliberal policies. They removed all restrictions of foreign capital. They have completely openly declared their fusion with Indian big capital. Indian big capital is free to operate foreign capital, hardly any regulation. So we've really seen India becoming integrated into a global capitalist economy on terms imposed by the global big guys. Within India, it's a corporate Hindutva policy, essentially aimed at attacking the peasantry and the working class. This is the content of it. But that kind of policy, in order to be implemented on the ground, will have to figure out how to confront resistance. Communist movement is one instance of resistance that they could not defeat. Okay? But in fact, especially because if you go back and look at the Communist movement, it united Muslims and Hindu peasants in the heartland of UP. The same area where BJP had capitalized on a Hindu-Muslim conflagration to win the 2019 elections. So this is a historic transition. It's not consistent. It's not that those guys will vote against BJP in the next election. That's not the point. Point is that when the toiling classes unite, you can defeat communal fascism, okay? Corporate communal fascism, which is what we have in India. Now, the perception that Modi is immensely popular is also fed by all these stories that you get. I'm not saying that he doesn't have a large popular following. He does. But it is magnified by the control of media they have. And when entities like BBC, when they raise questions about Modi's commitment to democracy, then the whole gang that Modi has with him jumps into the fray and state takes an ultra-nationalist posture. But Modi himself has remained very close to the US on foreign policy issues. India is part of the Quad, India, Australia, US, and Japan. India is part of the U2I2, which is the US, United Arab Emirates, Israel, and India. Indian private capital is doing big arms business with Israel, right in the middle of the genocide. Modi has not challenged any of these things. So the perception that Modi is some ultra-nationalist leader is bogus. See, he's a leader of basically supporting and helping the corporate sector, but he's also in alliance with US imperialism. In fact, you could say the Modi regime is a junior partner of US imperialism. Yet, there is a nuance here. You see, because on a climate change negotiation, India will go G77 and China, which is different from the US position, right? Such space is allowed within this relationship.
Right.
But in essence, it is a pro-imperialist government. So I think this whole narrative of high growth and all that, what on the other hand Oxfam brings out is the huge increase in inequality, right?
Right.
Now the point is, see, the tricky thing is that inequality has characterized India's capitalist development throughout. In fact, globally also capitalism is always characterized by inequality. Question is, what trends are there in different phases? And if you thought of 1945 to 73, the period of rapid economic growth of the world capitalist system, there was some degree of lessening of inequality, of very stark inequality. Post-1970s, the rise of liberalism across the world in the capitalist economies, inequality is widened, both within nations and across nations. India under Modi has become a far more unequal society, because what is the essence of his policies in terms of political economy? Huge concessions to the corporate sector. For example, in 2019, on the eve of the global pandemic, and they announced a reduction in the corporate tax rate from 30% to 22%, which is the lowest tax rate in the world at that time. Trump and Modi. Then they made more concessions in the budget that followed, and all of this went to boost Indian economy, but hasn't succeeded. Indian economy's growth rate is very tepid. It's not what they make it out to be. And such growth as has occurred is largely in the financial sector, in services of various kinds. And the dualism in the economy between a very tiny advanced financial sector reporting higher earnings and a very large make-work sector of the services, doing whatever you can to survive because there are no social security systems in place. This hides the reality of a struggling economy. So far from the picture that Modi's acolytes present, they don't provide hard data for the claim they're making. And you can see today that in India, even the reputation of Modi is on the line after this electoral bonds case, where the Supreme Court has delivered a fairly historic verdict. I mean, it remains to be seen what happened, because the Chandigarh election was there, the brazen cheating by BJP chief of president was caught on camera. I don't think the Indian people buy the narrative about Modi that is being sold in the international circles. No. Yes, some of them do, but not all.
And before we wrap this conversation up, would you have a final message for us?
I think we are, at a point in human historical development where, again, bring back what Rosa Luxemburg said, choice that the world faces is either socialism or barbarism. We're not going to be around forever. We'll be gone, but humanity will survive, hopefully. For humanity to survive, it has to transition to socialism. Prospects for that cannot be judged at any one moment in time. But the long-term direction of history suggests that as productive forces develop and human collective consciousness emerges and grows, such a day will come. So I remain optimistic, and I believe that we do take into account in India, especially because we were talking about identity politics, something we didn't discuss in the interview so much. In India, we have a very important set of issues of social oppression, besides economic exploitation. So the left has taken the position that we must fight both at once. Because the social oppression, based on the caste system untouchability, for example, other disabilities imposed on certain sections of the population, they are also tied to the production relations in the system. That is to say, denial of access to land and productive assets, denial of freedom of occupation. So you're directed to work within particular occupations. This whole system of endogamous marriage, which perpetuates the caste system. All these have to be fought as part of the base of production relations, not to be treated as some ideological edifice. So the caste system is embodied in very specific material practices and is empowered by a basic division of assets and rules of the game in the production system. Brahminical ideology, which is often talked about a great deal in the southern states, is one part of the story. It reinforces the caste system, it perpetuates it, but Brahminical ideology doesn't fall from the skies. So the basis is in the material production relations of the systems. You cannot fight the caste system without fighting class. And vice versa, our notion of fighting is to combine the struggle for economic equality with the struggle against social oppression. So this is the challenge that we are facing in India, specific to India. I don't know how it is in different places. Of course, we are also ethnicity and huge other complications, but that is the real world. It's a messy, clumsy world, but you deal with it. That's why we are here, to fight the good fight, as my friend Praveen Purkar would have said. Yes.
Prof. Venkatesh, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. Pleasure.
That was Professor Venkatesh Atria, economist and activist. I'm Darshan Johan, and this has been Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.